May it please the court, I'm Robert Marshall, the law firm of Carpenter and Plaskin, registration 2851. I'm appearing on behalf of the city of Aurora, and in that capacity, we're asking this court to reverse the lower court on the grounds that the lower court's decision was arbitrary, unjust, unfair, and not supported by the stipulated facts and by the law. We believe that this court can consider the evidence and the record before it on a de novo basis, because the facts were basically stipulated to, the exhibits were stipulated to, were there any disputed facts. So based upon that, you can review it de novo. It is Aurora's position that they were an innocent party throughout this entire transaction. All their actions were justified and supported by the facts and circumstances at the time of these events occurred. I would only briefly go into the history of this matter. It started in 1996 when Aurora entered into what's called a Trident Agreement with a Trident Partnership, where that partnership owned some ranch land in Park County, and they were going to try to have the water rights adjudicated, and if they succeeded, then Aurora would buy the water rights. If they didn't succeed, then Aurora was received approximately one half of the ranch. That is all the ranch land, 9,360 feet and below. That document was recorded in the Park County records, and the legal description to the ranch was attached as an exhibit to that document and gave notice to the world of Aurora's interest in the property. Aurora's interest was recognized as being a prior right by all parties at all times. In fact, it was emphasized back in 2002 that the partnership had to borrow money from Guaranty Bank. Guaranty Bank wanted a deed of trust, and Aurora said that they should recognize their prior rights, and they did. They signed a subordination agreement, and that document was recorded in the Park County records. So at all time, any interest that may have been claimed by the plaintiffs at any time would be inferior to the rights of Aurora and the rights to Guaranty Bank. In 2003, the plaintiffs obtained a judgment for costs in the water court. It was only against the Park County Sportsman Ranch defendants, and not against the individuals. And the judgments were recorded by Thornton in 2003, but by the only other plaintiffs in 2005. There was no judgment against Aurora for costs. In fact, Aurora was specifically absolved for any liability for costs by an order of the water court. So subsequent to the decision of the lower court, it was appealed in January 2005. The Supreme Court issued its opinion. And after that,
the counsel, the primary argument, as I understand it, with respect to your problem, is that the appellees are arguing that the 2008 supplemental agreement essentially voided or displaced the agreement that you recorded in 2002, and therefore you've lost your priority.
Your Honor, in response, we have argued, and I'll argue today, that the rights were vested in Aurora when the trade agreement was recorded, signed and recorded. They had a vested right in the property from that period forward. After the foreclosure sale, Aurora was entitled to negotiate with anyone who had title of the property, because they had the right of specific performance to enforce their rights to the property. So the rights were always as of 1996. In fact, the court recognized the priority interests of Aurora. The plaintiffs recognized the priority interests of Aurora. And so we believe at all times that was the right that they were receiving. And it went, no matter who had the rights, Aurora could come in and negotiate to get that property. What they did is, because there's a foreclosure and they were entitled to rely upon the quitclaim, the public trustee's deed, they went to what was then the JJWM partnership and asked for them to transfer the property. The property that was transferred was all within the outline of the property described in the legal description that was recorded with the Trident Agreement.
Mr. Marshall, but wasn't it different property than what the Trident Agreement contemplated?
It was somewhat different, yes, but it was all within the same legal description that was recorded with the Trident Agreement.
So description, you mean the whole ranch?
The whole ranch.
Yes. Not 9,300 feet and below.
No. What happens is, when they divided it, they found out that if you divided by elevation, that there wasn't access and there weren't contiguous parcels. So they divided up in separate, the contiguous parcels with access. It only made the property more valuable, because but it didn't change any of the property that was being conveyed, in the sense that we still got approximately one half the property. And actually, we got 50 acres less than what they would have gotten if they divided by elevation. And we've argued in our briefs and argued today that the plaintiffs were not harmed by this because they were always inferior to the rights of Aurora. And what happens when they divided the property, the one half that remained with the JJWM partnership is actually more valuable because of the way
it was divided.
Increased the value. And it, the plaintiffs couldn't recover anything to start out with because the liens against the property was $1.7 million by Guaranty Bank. Aurora's interest was $1.18 million. Their own expert testified at $920 an acre. The entire ranch is only worth $2.2 million. And so the encumbrances against the property were $2.88 million. And so there was no equity from which they could recover. That's why we've argued that they were not harmed by this whole thing, because it was obvious the reason they didn't redeem in the foreclosure was because there was no equity from which they could redeem. And we argued in our briefs that they did receive the notice because they didn't prove they did not. We had the presumption that the notice was received because it's properly mailed.
Well, they apparently put on evidence they didn't receive it, and the trial court apparently believed it.
What they put on, the evidence that they put on, was that they did not recall receiving it. There was only one person, the city attorney, that said that she did not get it. Everybody else said they didn't recall it. And the presumption is because it was mailed that it was received. So they didn't prove that they did not receive it. They just proved that they didn't recall getting it.
And I guess if it had been addressed to the correct address, I think your argument would make a lot of sense to me. But it was not correctly addressed.
Actually, Your Honor, one of the witnesses testified that if you mailed anything to the city of Thornton at Denver 80229, they got it. So actually, whether Civic Center or Civic Circle Drive didn't make any difference. They got it anyway. They always got mail that was delivered to Thornton at Denver 80229. They later changed it to Thornton 80229, but it didn't make any difference because they got it either way. And she said they got that mail on a regular basis.
I mean, despite that evidence, the trial court was in the best position to evaluate the credibility of the various folks, and the trial court said there was no proper notice to Thornton.
Actually, he didn't actually hold that. What he ended up, he didn't void the foreclosure. He just decided that he would fine for Thornton because they wouldn't recover their costs if he let Aurora win. And so he found on the basis of Aurora participated in the scheme by negotiating for transfer of the property. He never voided the foreclosure sale. In fact, our position before this court is that you should find that we were entitled to rely upon the public trustee's deed and the deed to get the guy from JJWN, because nobody argued or alleged that Aurora participated in anything. They were the holder of the property. They were entitled to negotiate with them, just like if anybody else had gone to the bank and purchased the note and foreclosed. Aurora could have come to them and said, we have a prior and superior interest in that property. Would you please convey it to us? Otherwise, we're going to have to file a suit to collect it. So we're entitled to negotiate for that transfer. We believe that this court should uphold the transfer from JJWM to Aurora because it was a valid transfer. They were obligated to transfer the property to Aurora free and clear of liens. That's what the Trident Agreement said. If for some reason you find that the foreclosure was invalid, which the lower court didn't, if you find it was invalid, then we're asking you under that doctrine of equitable subrogation to put Aurora back in its original position of having a prior and superior right to all the land below 9,360 feet, because that was the prior position that they had. If they took the deed, it was by mistake. If, in fact, the foreclosure wasn't good, and they should be put back in their original position because the plaintiffs were not damaged.
Down to a minute.
Wasn't Thorne, in fact, damaged because of this notice issue?
What?
So, if we're going to uphold an equitable remedy, isn't Thorne also entitled to that equitable relief?
Aurora was the one that was damaged because the court forfeited Aurora's interest in the property without Aurora doing anything wrong. The plaintiffs were unjustly enriched by this whole decision by the judge because he found out a claim that was not even made. By inventing some way to hold against Aurora and award the property of Thornton, at least the prior lien on the property of Thornton, without Aurora doing anything to cause this. It was just, he forfeited their rights. I guess I don't have much time left for rebuttal.
We'll give you a minute.
Thank you.
Mr. Bain?
My name's James Bain. As the court knows, I'm representing the remaining appellants. I'd like to reserve 6 minutes if I could. This appeal covers many reversible issues, but the primary issue is damages, or rather, no damages. Creditors certainly proved no damages. The jury, of course, found no damages on two of the claims, and those verdicts were supported by the evidence. Then the court nullified those verdicts by entering a judgment for damages. I'd like to...
The jury didn't enter the damages on the conspiracy claim?
I'm sorry?
The jury did not enter the damages on the conspiracy claim?
The jury did find damages on the conspiracy claim, Your Honor, and I think that came from the mandatory instruction 32 that directed them to find the same to the penny damages on the successor liability claim, which I think was also error for the court to have done that. But if I could, I'd like to address first the fraudulent transfer damages. 38.81092 limits the creditors to the lesser of one, the amount they sought to recover on their claim, and two, the net value of the asset. So they had the burden of proving both. They failed to do that. First, if we address the amount of their claim, they sought $1.1 million plus prejudgment interest. That turned out to be $1.9 million by the judgment. So by the end of 2006, when the transfer occurred, they were seeking to recover on their claim $1.5 million. So they had to find equity in the ranch of $1.5 million. As the court knows, the ranch was subject to two senior encumbrances, the bank's deed of trust and Aurora's interest. And as Mr. Marshall indicated, the plaintiffs put an appraiser on who said the entire ranch was worth 2.2. But that appraiser never addressed the value of the ranch excluding Aurora's interest. There was no evidence on what the value of the ranch would be without Aurora's interest. Now, as the court also knows, Aurora owned the land below 9,260 feet. And as Mr. Marshall indicated, that left the partnership with unconnected hilltops with minimum value after you get access easements. And the jury had to deduct Aurora's interest because the court determined that it would decide the validity of Aurora's interest. And the court had not made that determination before the jury began their deliberations. So there was no evidence whatsoever for the jury to determine what the net value of the ranch was. Although there was no value proof as to the net value of the asset, there was some indication that Aurora owned about half. So if you add half of that plus the bank's interest, it shows that there was no equity whatsoever in that ranch. The senior encumbrances is above the creditor's interest was at least $500,000 more than the ranch.
Doesn't that argument assume that you win the accommodation issue, though? Because if you lose the accommodation party issue, then the deed of trust and the note disappear.
I don't necessarily agree, Your Honor. I think the creditor's whole argument is based on that the individual defendants bought that note. They were on the 2002 note. But the evidence, the undisputed documents, indicate that those individual defendants did not buy the note. As set forth in my brief, all of the documents show they gave the money to JJWM, which then purchased the note and was that was assigned directly to the second partnership. So you don't even get to payment or merger. You don't even have to, you can never extinguish it under the doctrines of payment or merger, so you don't even have to get to accommodation party. If you do get to accommodation party, the Lasky's decision, which they almost entirely rely on, was interpreting a different statute. I would submit if this court was to decide the Lasky facts now, under the current statute, which is based on a direct benefit, and the official comment that now says shareholders don't get an indirect benefit, benefit, that last thing would be decided completely different than it would have been before. So that was the main argument they had on the accommodation party.
Is there any difference here since we have a partnership as opposed to a corporation with shareholders?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. The statute in the Limited Partnership Act indicates that limited partners are not liable. And indeed, there's a statute that says you'd have to pierce in order to make the limited partners. And there's not even a claim of piercing. So we'd never get to that. So in other words, for the creditors to have any equity, they have to not just eliminate the bank's deed of trust, they also have to eliminate Aurora's. They have to get rid of both to find any equity.
I'm sorry, I don't understand that. If the ranch is worth $2.2 million,
yes, sir,
of which Aurora has half, and the bank's deed of trust goes away by virtue of merger, why isn't there roughly $1 million in equity there?
Well, there's several problems. There's no proof as to what Aurora's interest was.
Well, if they had a 50-50 interest, and there's proof of the total.
No, they didn't have a 50-50 interest. They owned the property below 9,360 feet.
Is there evidence that that was, in fact, worth more than the high-altitude property?
I don't think there was any evidence. My understanding is their appraiser refused to value the property net of Aurora's interest.
That's what I meant when I said 50-50.
But it technically wasn't 50-50, so you can't say it's $1.1 million. Because there was absolutely proof on how much Aurora's interest was worth. It was about half of the land, but they had the lowland versus the unconnected hilltops. And there's no evidence whatsoever that that would be equal.
Except that when they renegotiated, they ended up with about half, only a different half.
That's right, Your Honor, but that was in 2008. That had nothing to do with when the transfer occurred in 2006. So in 2006, you had to value the property as of that time. That's what the act says. And the court asked before about, the plaintiffs couldn't have redeemed. Perhaps it was a problem with notice. But the legislature, who has adopted, of course, the procedures on foreclosure, has another procedure if you don't have adequate notice, and that's the omitted party. If you're an omitted party, you get a right to redeem later. So even if they didn't get the notice, which apparently there's some issue about, they did have the right as an omitted party later, but they never exercised that right because there was no...
Is it for them to exercise? Is there a time limit on them exercising that right? Or can they lay in the weeds indefinitely and exercise that right?
There's a time limit, Your Honor. Clearly, they could have done that by the time they filed their lawsuit. And they implicitly... They haven't yet. They implicitly recognize also there was no damages because they never submitted a damages instruction to the jury. They first asked the court to enter basically a directed verdict that all the damages on all the claims was the $1.1 million, and then they limited that to successor liability. So they never submitted a damage request to the jury because they knew there was no equity.
Well, why did they have to submit a damage request to the jury as opposed to letting the jury award damages? You don't submit a damage request in a personal injury case.
I meant a line on the verdict form. Their instruction was they requested the court to enter damages in the amount of their judgment liens for all the claims. Then they restricted that instruction 32 just to the successor liability claim. So there was no instructions on damages for fraudulent transfer or for conspiracy. And the only thing one can conclude is that the jury used the successor liability instruction, because it's matched to the penny, for the conspiracy damages despite its facial inapplicability. And if I could reserve the rest of my time, that'd be great.
Now, 5.5 minutes.
Thank you.
Mr. Rogers, you're handling it all.
I guess, for better or for worse.
So you have 25 minutes.
I will reserve nothing for rebuttal. May I please the court, counsel? Bill Rogers on behalf of all plaintiffs in this lawsuit from the firm of Woodruff and Haynes, and I have Rachel Morris and Brendan Loy with me at counsel table. This case arises out of a very, very clever plan to avoid a lawful debt. The artifices utilized and the legal machinations that were pursued by the defendants in this case were certainly ingenious. But at the end of the day, by their very own testimony, the architects of that plan admitted precisely why they had gone through all of these steps that otherwise made no logical sense whatsoever, and they admitted that purpose to the judge and to the jury in this case. The end result was that both the judge and the jury undid their deeds and entered judgment in favor of the plaintiffs properly. And what the plaintiffs are asking you to do is affirm that judgment as entered by the trial court.
The purpose was to avoid the junior leaners. Is that?
The purpose was to avoid
paying. The purpose they announced?
The purpose that they announced was, we formed this new partnership, we bought our old note, we assigned that note to our new partnership, and then we went ahead and foreclosed against ourselves, which was testimony from the partners, for the sole reason of eliminating the plaintiff's judgment liens, and therefore avoiding having to pay those judgments. That was the only purpose that they ever testified to during their depositions, as read to the jury, and during the trial. Their counsel argued different things in the briefing before this court, but the individual defendant's testimony could not have been more crystal clear, and we have referenced that specific testimony to you in the briefs. They admitted, because they themselves could come up with no other reason for having gone through these steps, that the only reason they did it was to eliminate these judgment liens. And
that isn't the question, so what?
The question, so what, is that the plaintiffs were all damaged and precluded from collecting the monies that they were legally and rightfully entitled to.
They had no equity in the land prior to this transaction.
They did have equity in the land once the defendant's scheme began to unfold. And therein lies really the crux of all of the various non-Aurora defendants' arguments in this case. And that is whether or not they were accommodation parties in conjunction with the original loan to PCSR.
Let me ask just a question. Let's assume, I'm not asking you to concede anything, assuming the note and deed of trust didn't go away by merger, do you agree that there was no equity in the ranch? Given Aurora's roughly 50-50 interest plus the $1.6 million on the bank note?
Well, and of course I wouldn't concede that, but I would agree that if we look at a specific snapshot in time prior to when the plan began to unfold anyway, that the bank had a note and deed of trust on the property, and Aurora had whatever interest may have been created by virtue of the Trident Agreement. It wasn't any type of a conveyance of property, but it certainly was some sort of document of record. And ultimately, if that document of record had been followed, if there had been some transfer pursuant to that, that was something that people were going to have to deal with. And that is obviously the Aurora versus the plaintiff's issue. But yeah, at some point in time, there were things of record on that title. I think the critical issue is that by virtue of having paid off that note, and there really is no factual issue here, the individual defendants, the four individuals, paid off that note.
Who wrote the check?
Exhibit 20, well, we don't need to know who wrote the check, Your Honor. We have a stipulated exhibit 21, the loan purchase agreement, and it provides any and all information that you need to know about what happened. The seller is identified as the bank. The purchasers are identified as the four individual partners, and they purchased the note and deed of trust from the bank. That document is undisputed, and their testimony at trial, which we have referenced to you in our briefs, is undisputed as well. We took the money that we borrowed on December 30th, and we used it to buy the note and deed of trust the next day. That was the testimony of the partners. And again, there's arguments now presented that in some fashion the transaction was structured differently. I'm not sure, frankly, that difference is significant, but the evidence is to the contrary. They paid off that note. The documents and their testimony confirm it. And when they did so, it ceased to exist. And the reason that is significant is because the entire defense of this case, both at trial and in the briefing really before this court on behalf of the Sportsman's Ranch defendants, is this notion that they were accommodation parties and that they were entitled to pay off their own note without extinguishing it.
And that is the core factual issue. And it is a factual issue, according to Section 419 itself. That is the core factual issue that was presented to the jury for determination. And they argued it to the jury. They asked their witnesses about issues relating to that theory of defense in front of the jury. They have argued that in more pages, I'm sorry to say, than this court would perhaps have liked to have seen in the briefing of this issue over and over and over again. But at the end of the day, they cannot show that that factual question was erroneously decided by the jury. Instead, they don't like the result, and they would like this court to give them another bite at it.
Okay, very specifically, what evidence is there in the record that the individual defendants received a direct benefit, as that is defined in 3419, especially comment one, from the loan?
It is. And the direct benefit issue is sort of, I think, what the discussion at the trial court level was, the tension between the decision of the Court of Appeals in Lasky and the comment in the UCC, in Section 419. The direct benefit that they received, I think, is akin to what the primary in Alaska, the plaintiff in the Lasky case, is akin to what he received when the money was borrowed and received out.
Take Lasky out of the equation. Assume you decide the case solely under 419 and comment one. Where is there any evidence in the record of direct benefit?
The evidence of direct benefit is the fact that at the time this active note was received, and remember, factually, we have a situation where the partnership had actually borrowed, I think, $2.8 million during the Water Corp proceeding. The Water Corp proceeding had been lost in 2001. In 2002, there wasn't some new loan achieved. It was simply a restructuring of that debt. Money was paid down. Now the loan balance was $1.5 million in the March of 2002. So the original borrowing of money, though it's reflected in that 2002 note, is to pursue the Water Corp application and obtain what the partners hoped would be millions of dollars worth of profit had the water application been successful. The benefit to them is through that.
Okay, you're just making the last year argument.
I am, but here's why I think that's significant, Judge, because that particular issue is certainly one that the comments identify. The actual language of 419 doesn't, but what I think is significant about that is that it's unquestionably an issue of fact that needs to be decided, and direct benefit is unquestionably one of the factors that needs to be considered, and both legally and factually by the finder of fact, I would submit. And we know that if for no other reason than the manner in which the note or the instrument is endorsed is not dispositive. And what I mean by that, if you look at 419, if someone signs as a maker and specifically states in there, I think it's 419C, I'm a guarantor. Oh, and I'm not just that, I'm an accommodation party as well. That's a presumption, but it's not dispositive. And I think that's what's significant about looking at 419 as a whole. That's why it is a factual question that needs to be decided. And direct benefit was part of the jury instruction. It came from the defendant.
Okay, I agree with everything you said, but I'm not sure I've heard an answer to my question. If you take the Lasky, this helps our business interests, out of the equation, where exactly is there any evidence of direct benefit?
Unquestionably, the benefit flows through from the partnership.
So it's a Lasky benefit.
It is. It has to be.
Thank you.
It has to be.
To whom was the note and deed of trust assigned?
The note and deed of trust in 2005 was assigned to the second partnership, JJWM, pursuant to the terms of the loan purchase agreement from December 31, 2005. I'd like to touch on a couple of the claims, sort of in order. I'll get as far as I can anyway. Successor liability, I think, is the easiest for this court to affirm, and I think it's recognized.
Which one is
successor easy? Liability. I think it's recognized by the appellants. Of the 28-page briefs that the partnership appellants filed, both in the opening brief and the reply, 5 pages is devoted to successor liability. The jury and the judge both independently determined that JJWM was a successor entity to PCSR, Park County Sportsman's Ranch, and all they needed to do was reach that conclusion on one of the 3 theories that were identified for them in the jury instructions, and properly, and that is whether it was a mere continuation of the seller, whether there was some sort of assumption of liability or whether or not it was a transfer between the two entities, to get the language right, for the fraudulent purpose of escaping liability. In this case, the evidence absolutely and robustly supports both the verdict of the judge and the verdict of the jury.
The original partnership didn't convey anything.
The original partnership and its partners most certainly conveyed things through the foreclosure process itself. The sham foreclosure...
They bought the note and deed of trust from the bank. The bank had an interest in the property. That interest is separate and distinct from the interest of the partnership and or the city of Aurora. They bought that interest and foreclosed that interest. How did the original partnership, Park County Ranch, convey anything to the new partnership?
At the end of the day, Judge, the title to the ranch was held by JJWM. Prior to the foreclosure, the title to the ranch was held by PCSR, the first partnership. The partners themselves testified that the reason they did that was to transfer the ranch from their one partnership wearing the PCSR hat to their other partnership wearing the JJWM hat. That was their testimony. And that was exactly what the entire scheme was designed to accomplish. That's why...
I understand what the scheme was designed to accomplish. My question is, what interest did the original partnership convey to the successive partnership?
Its ownership interest in the ranch.
Didn't have
foreclosure. It had an ownership interest subject to a note and deed of trust that was held by Guaranty Bank, which was subsequently eliminated. But in any event, it, through its artifices of creating the second partnership and foreclosing back against itself, it transferred the ranch from the first partnership to the second partnership. That's not disputed by the individual defendants or the partnerships at the time of trial, or I don't even believe at this point. They question whether a foreclosure can constitute a sale for purposes of successor liability. That's the argument that's presented. But there's no suggestion.
That's sort of what I'm getting at. I'm just trying to explore the partnership. The original partnership surrendered its interest in property to Guaranty National Bank, or Guaranty Bank, in 2002, or some very early date.
There's a note that doesn't, of course, and a deed of trust that is an interest in the property, but it's not the title to the property. It's simply a portion of the property's economically $1.6 million, I suppose, towards the ranch.
And that's the interest that was foreclosed.
It is,
and ultimately conveyed to the successor, partnership.
The interest, such as it was certainly foreclosed, and it's that foreclosure process that transferred the title once they took their invalid note and submitted it as part of
and after giving your clients an opportunity to redeem.
Well, actually, they didn't. But
didn't
they? Didn't give notice.
I thought they gave notice to everybody but Thornton.
They didn't give notice to four of the five plaintiffs because four of the five plaintiffs did not have addresses on the transcripts of judgment, which was one of the issues at the trial court level. Although they knew who the plaintiffs were and had been dealing with them for a number of years, they nevertheless did not give notice of the foreclosure to any of the plaintiffs. The city of Thornton had its address on the transcript of judgment. They didn't give proper notice to the city of Thornton either. But that's distinct from, I think, what you're asking about. And I want to answer your question because it is through the use of this foreclosure mechanism that both the trial court and the jury concluded they had used that otherwise proper and legal and appropriate process, not that it was necessarily appropriate in all respects here, but they used that otherwise legal process to fraudulently and improperly transfer this ranch property from one to the other. That's what they admitted that they did. That was their testimony at the time of trial, and they did it.
I don't think they admitted fraudulently, did they?
They did not.
Okay.
Unquestionably, they did not.
Let me pick up one point on your successor liability argument. There's a supersedious bond posted that's in excess of the amount of the liens and interest, correct?
There is.
If we affirm the successor liability, then don't you get paid out of the bond and everything else becomes moot, including the Aurora issues?
I do.
Okay. Thank you.
There may be some issue of disagreement with my learned brethren, but I think it's relatively
clear. I will give them a chance to answer the same question.
So that's the easiest one for you to address. The other two, I want to give myself a little bit of time to talk about Aurora, but I think the
the CUFTA claim, the fraudulent conveyance claim, really does come down to this issue of accommodation party, because which if that factual finding by the jury is not overturned by this court, then they're really stripped away of really all of the arguments that they made to the trial court and all of the arguments that they've made to this court as well, because nothing else flows for them. There was ample equity in that property if that deed of trust and securing the loan was extinguished. There was ample property and ample equity. The conspiracy claim is the arguments are largely derivative, just like a conspiracy claim is derivative.
Do you agree if we were to rule against you on the CUFTA claim, the conspiracy claim falls as well?
It pains me to do so, but it is certainly a derivative claim.
Thank you.
And it has to have an underlying action, which in this case it unquestionably did. I mean, I think what is significant here is that both the judge and the jury found convincingly and overwhelmingly in favor of the plaintiffs on all three causes of action, all three of those claims for relief. And it really, it frankly couldn't have been a more convincing result from the perspective of the finder of fact and what they were communicating that they felt and what they determined. And the legal instructions that laid out the three claims for relief that they were asked to consider, you've seen the arguments, and there's been ample briefing on all of those issues, and I'm not going to regurgitate all of that here. But I think at the end of the day, this was a set of pretty comprehensive instructions that was provided to this jury on a set of what I think a lot of people will consider to be at least reasonably complicated issues and a reasonably complicated set of facts that they had to work their way through.
Mr. Rogers, can you address your opponent's argument that there was not a request for damages on two of the three claims?
Yes, I can. And I think it's a pretty significant issue in the sense that more is being made out of it than ever possibly should be. And the reason is this. It's undisputed in the briefing that two of the three claims are equitable, and the CUFTA claim is equitable, and the successor liability claim is unquestionably equitable. The jury issued factual findings that needed to be resolved by the trial court. He needed to decide what to do with those, and that's on the successor liability. Okay, great. Alternatively, these plaintiffs have won on both of their alternative arguments, which was namely undo this foreclosure because it was a fraudulent conveyance, or alternatively, make our judgments follow through to partnership number two, which is nothing more than a sham. We could have only won on one of those causes of action or claims for relief with the jury or essentially with the judge, but we didn't. The plaintiffs prevailed on both of those claims. So the trial judge had it within his equitable power to resolve and determine what he felt was the most equitable result. And he did that by putting the title to the property or keeping the title to the property in partnership two, JJWM, subject to the original liens. The only claim for relief that could possibly carry with it legal damages beyond equitable type relief is the conspiracy claim. And it's not speculation. It's precisely what the jury did. And there's a lot of argument about, you know, it could have been damages here or there or somewhere in between. But I would defy my opponents to stand up and tell you how possibly could this jury or this judge have come to a number that differed from that stipulated amount. There's no vector or avenue for that to happen. Once the accommodation party issue was decided adversely to their interests, then it was over. That was the number, and it had to be the number. I have 7 minutes left, and there's a certain amount of...
I don't have any rule that says you have to use them.
I know. I have sat down before, but it seems sort of unfair not to address some of the issues that are raised by the city of Aurora on the purely equitable aspect of it. I think the first and foremost issue that guides your review of the trial judge's considered verdict on this quiet title claim is a standard of review. It's an incredibly difficult burden to overcome, this abuse of discretion. Was the judge's verdict on that claim manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair? And that is an exceedingly high burden. Is there anything in the record that could support the judge's decisions on equity? And I would submit to this court that there was ample evidence in this record to support his equitable determinations with regard to the Sportsman's Ranch defendants and with regard to the city of Aurora.
Let's assume, again, not if you concede anything, that we rule against you on the accommodation party issue, then the CUFTA claim falls and the conspiracy claim falls, correct?
I would say that if the CUFTA claim falls, the conspiracy claim falls.
Well, if you lose the accommodation party issue, doesn't the CUFTA claim fall?
I think to lose the I suppose it depends on what this court might fashion in a way that would
result in me losing that issue, because...
Well, I think we would say that the deed of trust and note didn't disappear by merger.
That it wasn't a factual question, that as a matter of law, that the plaintiffs have to lose?
No, it's a factual question, but there's no evidence in the record of direct benefit.
I think...
Well, I'm not trying to beat you up.
I'll hold on that for a second because you asked me to.
I appreciate that courtesy. Okay. Then wouldn't it be appropriate to remand to the trial court to make further findings on the Aurora issue, because we've essentially said that while this scheme may have been clever, it was not unlawful?
I don't think so.
Okay. Let's assume again, just to humor me, let's assume you lose those other issues. Why does Aurora still lose?
Aurora still loses with regard to the priority issues, because we have the successor liability claim that places the plaintiff judgment liens against that ranch property now in the hands of JJWM. That issue always was and always will be independent of the statutory claim arising out of CUFTA. So that is the way things go. Then, if you wanted to revisit the considered decision of the trial court in meeting out that equitable discrepancy or determination then between the plaintiffs and Aurora, you would have to somehow say that Aurora should have an interest, and it was eliminated by the trial court. But let's assume for a second that this court were to say, we want to revitalize that interest of Aurora. Then you need to determine, well, should we disagree with the trial court's decision in equity and place it back in front of the interests of the plaintiffs?
No, I think I'm trying to give you a third option.
All right.
The third option would be to say, Judge, we've concluded that there is insufficient evidence in this record to support a finding of fraud. Therefore, you can't void Aurora's interest for that reason, but you can still exercise your equitable discretion in some other way should you choose to do so on the lien priorities, and we're remanding for you to make new findings on that subject.
Okay. Let's assume for a second that this court was inclined to do that. I don't believe a remand would nevertheless be necessary, and this is why.
Please.
You can assume for a second that you disagree with the finder of fact on whether or not he felt Aurora had sat on its hands and willfully sat by to let this fraud play out so that they could take the benefit of that action. You could disagree with the trial court on that. You nevertheless would also have to find that Aurora properly took title in January 2008 under the quitclaim deed from JJWM, and that transfer should relate back to the Trident Agreement from 1996.
Why isn't that a potentially disputable factual issue, which the trial court has not yet resolved because it simply voided Aurora's interest?
I think it's pretty clear from the verdict of the trial court, because that was what so much of the argument that was presented to him in the case was. I think it's abundantly clear, quite frankly, from his verdict that he made that decision. He talks in terms about it being from a different party, JJWM versus PCSR. The verdict talks in terms of it being a different party than that that was identified in the Trident Agreement. He addresses those issues already. There would be no reason for you to send it back to him to readdress those issues, nor any reasonable belief that there would be any kind of a different result. Now, maybe the trial judge, if you sent it back to him and said, we don't agree with you, Judge Barton, in terms of the fraud aspect of it, or that aspect of your ruling, but we'd like you to consider the timing issue and the overall equities. To me, Judge, that seems unwarranted, even under the set of assumptions that you've asked me to take, because, you know, the argument from Aurora's perspective is sort of like the accommodation party issue from the defendants. It always, we gave notice. The 1996 Trident Agreement was everything, and we get to go back to that. It doesn't matter what happened in between. But I think when you're going to claim that something was recorded of record and gave notice to the world about what might happen in the future, and you're going to claim that somebody else who comes along later with an interest in the property is junior to you because of that notice way back when, well, guys, you better take it pursuant to the precise terms of that notice that you gave, because otherwise you've given notice to the world of one thing, and then you've turned around and done something else. And that is not equity to permit that to date back. Perhaps this court might determine that Aurora still has some sort of interest in the property. But I think it would not do equity to determine that Aurora's interest in some fashion was senior to those judgment plaintiffs who were dragged along on this unfortunate water scheme and forced to spend $1 million in costs to get the thing thrown out because it was misguided in the first place. The entity that was pursuing that water application was PCSR, as agent of and funded by Aurora. And the judge considered those equities when he made his considered decision. And I don't believe, given the strong standard of deference that applies to that determination, that it would be appropriate to go back and unwind what he has done. I will sit down with 30 seconds. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You said you'd give me 1 minute?
I'll give you 1 minute.
I will make it very brief.
A minute and 13 seconds, unless the bailiff takes it off.
If the plaintiffs would have attempted to collect their cost judgment commencing in 2002, they would have to go against the ranch. They had the liens against it of Guaranty Bank and the interest of Aurora. There was nothing to collect. So they did nothing from 2003 to 2008. And now they're coming back and trying to set aside, have the court affirm the lower court's forfeiture of Aurora's interest in the property. We still maintain that when you give notice through the recording of the Trident agreement, there's a notice to all the property. The cases we're talking about where you have to, the notice doesn't apply if it's different property, was when there's entirely different parcels. This was still the same parcel. It was just divided a little bit differently. Equity should still prevail, that Aurora should get its interest in this property, whether it be back to the original priority position of everything between 9,360 feet, or under your question, if in fact there was no fraud, then the deed to Aurora was valid, and they should have received the property free and clear of liens as it was provided for under the Trident agreement.
Okay, but if even if the lien is valid, couldn't the trial court, even if the quitclaim deed is valid, couldn't the trial court still weigh the equities and make factual findings that would give the plaintiff's liens a super priority? I mean, you may not agree with that outcome, but isn't that, aren't there facts that would permit that conclusion?
That's what he did before, but his basis was it was fraud. And this time, if you look at just the Recording Act, then I don't believe there's any other reason to hold that Aurora didn't have a prior and superior position.
Thank you.
Thank you.
5.5 minutes, sir.
Okay.
Let me start with the question I asked your adversary, and I gave you a chance to comment on as well. In light of the supersedious bonds, if we affirm the successor liability verdict, then don't the liens just get paid out of the bond and everything else goes away? I mean, subject to a Supreme Court reversal?
I haven't studied that, but I think you're right, Your Honor. However, here, the court instructed the jury to award $1.1 million on successor liability. I think that was error. The jury then refused to comply with that instruction. The jury wrote in $0 damages, wrote on the verdict form $0 damages.
Isn't relief on a successor liability claim a matter of the court's equitable power in the first instance?
You know, in a perfect world, I think that's right, Your Honor. But clearly, the creditors here elected the remedy to seek damages. They started in their complaint. They went through their response and summary judgment. They did it in their argument on the jury instructions. They submitted jury instructions on it. They submitted verdict forms calling for the jury to determine damages. You can't affirm the jury. You can't affirm the judgment without contradicting the verdict, finding zero damages on successor liability. You would be nullifying the jury verdict if you affirm that decision, because you can't separate the jury's finding of liability from its finding on damages.
Okay, two questions.
Okay.
The amount of the liens is not disputed, correct?
Yes, that's true.
All right. Forgetting about damages, the jury did find successor liability, correct?
They did.
You know, doesn't that mean, you know, discounting intervening BFPs and so forth, doesn't that mean that the new partnership today is liable to the plaintiffs for $1.1 million?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because first of all, that the jury instruction was deficient. The jury instruction, instruction 29, was disjunctive. So if the jury found any of those three paragraphs, it had to find successor liability. One of them was you should find successor liability if there was a fraudulent purpose. And then instruction 31 defined that as escaping liability for debts. That intent is not sufficient for successor liability in Colorado.
I think, I apologize, I asked my question poorly. You're attacking the jury's finding of successor liability. I'm asking you to take that as a given
if there's successor liability, and if the amount of the liens is undisputed, what difference does it make whether there's some confusion over the damages for the successor liability claim? Because you're still liable on the liens.
Well, I think because those two decisions are interdependent, the jury determined both liability and damages. If there was no damage decision, they might not have answered the same way on liability, because those were two are tied. The jury went so far as to not comply with the court's express instruction to fine $1.1 million of damages for successor liability. They failed to comply with the court's instruction, directly contradicted it and wrote in zero.
Okay, is your bottom line that the instructions on successor liability are so screwed up that that claim should be retried?
Yes.
Thank you.
Also, I think we should address equity here, because my opponent wanted to talk about equity. We had a situation where the creditors had judgment liens that were subject to the two senior lien interests. They had no expectation of recovery. Indeed, that was confirmed because they didn't do anything to collect on those liens from 2003 till 2007. Then they discovered this, and they said, this lawsuit will change our lot. So they used this lawsuit to transfer their junior lien interest into $1.9 million judgments against the individual defendants who had no liability, no obligation to pay the partnership. Plus, they got not the junior liens, but now they have the senior liens. So that's a total windfall for them that they had no expectation of recovering before. On the accommodation party, my opponent talked about Plaintiff's Exhibit 21, and that was the contract. Well, you'll notice the signature line on that is JJWM, and it's signed by JJWM. You'll also look at, if you look at the court's order on Aurora, you'll see the court found that JJWM purchased and paid under that arrangement. If you look at the plaintiff's complaint, you'll see that they allege that JJWM purchased the note and deed of trust. It's only now that we're hearing a different story. And the documents, which are in my brief, are just as, I think, clear as can be. The checks came from the individuals to the partnership, went to the bank. The bank assigned it directly to JJWM, both the note and the deed of trust.
Are you saying that under Exhibit 21, the individual defendants were not parties to that contract? They signed only in a representative capacity as limited partners?
You know, I have to say that looking at it objectively, Your Honor, it's ambiguous.
Okay.
The parties are listed in the front and the partnership signs the back. But it's clear on the undisputed documents how the money was paid and where it went.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Well, we thank you for leaving this relatively minor problem in our lap. Arguments are closed. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.